Okay, Purim, Tavshin Samach Tes. What we're going to do is we're going to try to make sense out of a statement in the Gemara in Yuma regarding Purim. And we're going to try to understand the concept of dawn and light. And what we kind of just, without thinking, sing in Shoshanas Yaakov, we say, Tshuasam Hayisa LaNetzach. Their salvation, their Yeshua, was eternal. Unlike other forms of Yeshua, I guess, which were not eternal, the miracle of Purim and the salvation of Purim represents eternal salvation. Tshuasam Hayisa LaNetzach. And what we're really saying is, what the Medrash in Mishlei says, and what Rambam brings down in Hilchos Megillah, Perek Beis, Halacha Yudches, he says, all Yom Tovim will be batel in the future except Purim. Purim is something that is eternal. Purim is something that will stay with us. Purim, though it's one day and there's no Isser on Malacha and we don't feel the holiness like Yom Kippur, even though it's called Purim, Yom HaKippurim. Nevertheless, that's the yontif that we're going to stay with, that we're going to retain. That is the yontif that's lenesach. That is the yontif that we say, lehudim haisa ora, v'simcha, v'sason, v'yikar, all kinds of expressions of joy and happiness and light. And that really we'll try to understand all of this and this important role that Purim plays, and especially understand this Gemara in Yuma that says the following. And Tehillim Chaf Beis, Lam Natzeach Al Ayelas HaShachar, right? So the Gemara in Yuma says the following. Why? We know that that is a reference to Esther. Lama Nimshala Esther LaShachar. Why is Esther compared to the dawn? Lomar Lecha, to tell you, Ma Shachar Sof Kol HaLayla, just like the dawn is the end of the whole night, Kol HaLayla. Af Esther Sof Kol HaNisim. So Esther is the end of all the Nisim. Now, we've worked with this subject before. We're going to take it down a little bit of a different road and add some more ideas to it and develop it further and even understand some psukim in next week's Parsha Kisisa based on this idea. So if you have any memory of hearing this, this is the next level, okay? What does that mean? Esther is compared to Shachar, the dawn. Like the dawn is the end of the night, so Esther is the end of all the Nisim. So wait a second, if we're doing a comparison here, the Nisim are associated with the night. Is night good or bad? Night is always used as a kind of, to give us an image of galus, darkness, fear, being alone, feeling abandoned, not understanding. And the dawn is always used in terms of light and awareness and happiness and the good times, right? Geula, that's the morning, that's the light. So we are saying that Esther's nes, okay, in other words, the nisim of Purim, are like the dawn, finally after the long night of all the previous nisim of the previous 1,000 years. Now, there's a big difference between the nes of Purim and the nes of all of the previous 1,000 years, and that is, as you well know, that the nes of Purim has nothing in common with the nisim that preceded it. The nisim that preceded it, all for the last 1,000 years, which are called the era of Nevuah, the era of prophecy, they are all open miracles, starting in Mitzrayim with the Makos, through the Midbar, through the entrance in Tertul, through the time of the Shoftim, and through the kings. Even Eliyahu was doing basically open miracles on Har HaKarmel. This was an era of open miracles, and we don't normally think of that era as the night, as the darkness. We think of that era as the glory days of the Jewish people, the time where there were prophets telling us what to do. Okay, we did make our mistakes, no question about it, but nevertheless we had prophecy. We had a choshen with an Urim v'Tumim. We had an Aron in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. We had miracles on a regular basis taking place in the Beis HaMikdash that people could come and see. We had the Kruvim, and they opened the doors on Yom Tov, and people could see the Kruvim embracing. So these aren't normally the days that we think of as the dark night. And finally, in Gullus Bavel, that's the dawn. Now let's think about it. It's true that Esther was a major player in a great miracle that led to the salvation of the Jewish people, right? But how did her salvation come about? it wasn't exactly, you know, an appealing situation that she found herself in. And the nace did not even come about in very edifying means, you know what I mean? This was not a nace where she could stand, you know, in full pride, in a sense, that she was, proving HaKadosh Baruch Hu's intervention for the Jewish people. She had to submit herself to most, unappealing, as we said, not desirable situation. She had to be married to a guy, and let's make, and not just a non-Jew. We're talking about a very unique form of a non-Jew. You know, think about the Iranian world today and the Iraqi world today. You remember when Saddam was found? Remember when he was attacked? And remember when they found his sons, Uday and Kusai, whatever? Remember they found their palaces and their harems and the description of what was going on there? That's what we're talking about. This is a horrible world to be in, certainly as a woman. And Achashverosh was, not the most, progressive and civilized of men when it came to the concept of women. And that's where she had to play out her part. You know, the whole nace is like a gullus kind of an ace. You know, it's not a geula kind of an ace. So, and that's the dawn. That's the bright times. And furthermore, in Micha, it says that, we make a reference really to Esther, rather. Let me start like this. We make a reference to Esther that the miracles of Esther being the dawn are really give us a glimpse at the light at the end of the historical tunnel. In other words, Esther represents Achras Hayamim. Esther represents the miracles of the end of days. Just like it says, she's the dawn. All Yom Tovim will be batal, right? Only Purim will stay with us. So this is where we're talking about the end of days, Chuasam Hayisa LaNetzach, and we say in Micha that the miracles of the end of days will make the miracles of Mitzrayim pale in significance. So Micha Perek Zayin Pasuk Tesvav, Ki Mei Tzeischa Me'eretz Mitzrayim, like the days when I took you out of Mitzrayim, Ere'enu Niflos, I will show you great wonders. Just like that, some say even greater, because Pesach will be batal and Purim won't. And that's what we're talking about. I mean, spare us from these type of salvations. Okay? These are not the kind we want. And Esther suffered great personal sacrifice, according to Chazal, for her role that she had to play. And so, we'd rather have the Nisim, we would think, of Mitzrayim. So what is this? What is so much greater about the Nisim of Purim than the Nisim of the early days? And what is the association really between Pesach, which be Well, hanging up on whoever you are. Okay, I'm sorry. What is the association really between Pesach and Purim? If Pesach were the great, great, great open miracles of the beginning of Jewish history, and Purim are these great hidden miracles at the end of Jewish history, you might say, or giving us a glimpse at the end of Jewish history, we have to look for a running theme, a connection between Pesach and Purim. If Purim will outshine Pesach, outlast Pesach, be la netzach, be the only holiday that's not batal, okay? It is the dawn, and Pesach obviously is the beginning of the night because it started the 1,000-year period of darkness, as the Gemara says. So we have to look for a comparison between Pesach and Purim. So let's notice a few interesting halachas. First of all, there must be a link between Pesach and Purim. We normally think that Purim comes right before Pesach, right? That's how we think about it. It's like saying December comes right before January. But that's not how we think about December and January. Pesach is the beginning of the year, and Purim is the end. Purim comes full circle. However, Purim always must be next to Pesach. If there's two Adars, where do you put Purim? Right, because they touch up on each other. They come around and bump up against each other. Pesach starts the circle, Purim finishes it, but it must reconnect to Pesach. Okay? In fact, the Gemara tells us in Tanis, Adar is the beginning of the Nisim of Purim and Pesach, and puts Purim in a weird way before Pesach, linked to Pesach, and then you begin to think that there's a whole bunch of similarities between the Nisim of Pesach and the Nisim of Purim. For example, Pesach, why didn't the dough rise? Because they were in a big rush, right? Their salvation was because of this rush that they were in, and the great miracle of the dough not rising. Where do you find this rushing in the Purim story?
They rush Haman.
They're always rushing Haman, and Haman's always rushing. He comes in the middle of the night to the king to hang Mordechai. He writes the decrees and sends out the original letters in the middle of the night. He's always rushing. Okay, things take place in the middle of the night in both times, always in a state of, you know, trying to beat the clock. We retell the story of Pesach in what book? What's it called?
Haggadah.
And that's question-answer stories in a form of discovery, question-and-answer, conversation, explanation, analysis, all of that. How do we tell the story of Purim? In the Megillah, which we have to read. And what about in each of those? Okay, Pesach, when we tell the story, we punctuate the story with four cups of wine. Purim, when we tell the story, we tell the story of what happened, and then we think, you say you should drink so much wine, also wine, until you don't even know the difference between Baruch Mordechai and Arur Haman. So there's wine figuring in both, there's a retelling of the story, and then there's a big emphasis regarding Pesach and Purim of tzedakah and achdus and regrouping and all of that. Of course, there's Kimcha de Pischa, there's Matanas Levyonim. By the way, this year Matanas Levyonim should be way more, put more attention to it than the Shalach Manas, that's for sure. That's what's really necessary. And furthermore, you find that not only that, but the Kabbalah Satorah. The whole point of leaving Mitzrayim was Kabbalah Satorah. And of course, Purim, we know, Kimu v'Kiblu. So you see, there's got to be, it's a continuation. The proof that it's a continuation is this also. When Esther and Mordechai wrote the story of Purim, the Tanakh, the Sifrei Tanakh, the decision to include specific Sfarim and consider them holy of the highest level Sifrei Tanakh was not yet fully concluded. There was still a discussion. The decision was not made. Esther petitioned with Mordechai, being that they were both Nevi'im, because they both had come from Eretz Yisrael, and they had lived in the time of the Beis Hamikdash, and they had lived in the time when there was Nevuah, and despite the fact that Nevuah was being taken away from us, and everything was changing, they still were part of that, you know, previous era. And they insisted, they petitioned, really, I guess, the Anshei Knesset Gedolah at the time, to include this story as a Sifrei Tanakh, and then seal it. This would be the end. And only these 24 books would be considered Sifrei Tanakh. And the Anshei Knesset Gedolah didn't want to include this story. They said it has nothing in common with the other 23 Sfarim, which are all open prophecies, open miracles. You know, they tell a different type of a story. This is not at all. This is a Gullah story. This is a hidden miracle. This is the survival of the Jewish people, but not really a proof of, you might say, of like the Makos in Mitzrayim, or in the Midbar, or on the Yam. Proof, I am Hashem. This is more a survival of the Jewish people story. Esther and Mordechai insisted, and there was a back and forth, and it was included in Tanakh, and Tanakh was sealed. So on the one hand, it's very different than all the other previous miracles. On the other hand, it completes what Pesach started, really, what their Torah begins with, where the Nisim began. And yet, as we come back to this Gemara that says, but that all was the night, and Esther is the dawn. So what we have to get a grasp on is, what is the miracle of Purim? And how does it make all of these ideas really come together and make sense? So, one thing we know for sure about the Nisim that took place from Yetzias Mitzrayim until the Korban, until Esther. If you ask anybody, what was the point of the Nisim? What was the point of the Makos? What was the point of the Nisim on the Yam? What was the point of giving Klal Yisrael the Torah? And giving them the Torah in such a manner of awe and shock and astonishment and overwhelming revelation and clarity of Ani Hashem. What was the point of all of that? So you would say the point of it was for the Jewish people and for the nations of the world, very obvious, for the Jewish people to make it, to kind of like sear it into our knowledge and into our memory that there's only one Hashem, Anochi, Einod Milvado, Hashem is creator and master of the world, to follow his Torah and follow his mitzvahs and accept it lovingly and willingly. And certainly for the nations of the world, the point was to prove to them there's only one way, And you really can't, you know, you can't really undermine the ultimate will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hashem's will prevail. If you don't cooperate or do what's right, do the makos, the punishments, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a plan for history, a plan for the Jewish people, and you might as well just surrender and play along, right? That was the point of all the huge miracles and the constant miracles throughout the ages. So here's the question, and we kind of know the answer, but we never really say it. Did it work? Did it work? Was it successful? Did it get the Jewish people to unconditionally commit to the Torah and the mitzvos and never falter, never fall back? Did it get the nations of the world to surrender and throw in their lot with the Jewish people and help us and aid us and respect their laws and respect their lifestyle? Did it work? No, it didn't work. 1,000 years of open miracles and communication and prophecy and all of that, and guess what? It didn't work. Not really, not in the long term, not for the Jews who lost the Beis HaMikdash and were guilty of terrible averus, even on a smaller level, but some degree. And it didn't work for the nations of the world. Since that time, there's not been a single nation that hasn't made their attempt, basically, to destroy us, to annihilate us and destroy the Torah and what we stand for and the mitzvahs we live by. So it didn't work. That's the bottom line. So that's strange. Here HaKadosh Baruch Hu is himself breaking open the heavens and revealing his power and his might and trying to influence people and change humanity's, destiny, put everybody on the right path, shock us into clarity, give us instructions, you know, constantly remind us of what we're supposed to do, constantly re-interfere in history again and again and again, teaching us the same lesson over and over again, and it didn't work. Okay. However, we're going to see that the way Chazal see Purim as a nace that takes place in a whole different way, and that nace is lanetzach. That nace works. That type of experience doesn't go away and is transformative, and that type of nace causes our enemies to surrender completely, forever, and causes Klal Yisrael to accept the Torah completely and forever. And that is what's going to be at the end of days. But it's all hidden under the surface, because anything that relates to the end of days is always hidden. The greater something is, the more private it is, the more quiet it is, the more not revealed it is. The miracle of Purim, as we know, is of course the miracle of Jewish survival. But we really could give the Megillah a different name. We could call the Megillah the story of the frustration of Haman and the rest of our enemies. Okay? Think about it. If you were Haman, okay, and Haman represents all of our enemies, all of our worst enemies. Don't forget, he was one ringleader and everybody else just followed along. You don't need a whole nation of Amalekis, you need one and everybody else to follow along. Okay? Haman is our worst enemy. Haman represents the most violent forces against us, okay, where no salvation, completely, the forces that are so bent on our destruction, there's no way to logic with them, and that's it. What happens if you were Haman? How would you feel, okay? Now, notice who Haman is. He hates the Jews, way before Mordechai didn't bow down to him, but there's more going on there. Built into Haman's hatred for the Jews is also, in his own mind, his own tremendous ambitions. Haman is very ambitious. Proof. Proof is this. Chazal tells us, if you piece it together, that Ahasuerus, who might be Xerxes, by the way, or Cambyses, if you're interested in Persian history, was not himself of royal lineage in Persia. He was like a very powerful warlord. And yet he married the conquered emperor's granddaughter, Nebuchadnezzar's granddaughter. Persia had conquered Babylon, and yet Nebuchadnezzar had been originally the emperor of Babylon, Iraq. Persia conquered Babylon, Iran, and he married Vashti. So really his legitimacy to the throne in a way was through his wife. Now Haman was pretty much equally powerful, maybe a little less, but was very ambitious and he wanted the throne. So when there was an opportunity that arose for him to do something to put himself in a better footing, to maybe get one step closer to the throne, he was waiting and watching for that opportunity. You know, if there's a fire drill and you prepare, so when there's a fire, you're prepared, you're ready to do what you got to do. You only come up with the right answer at the right time if you're ready and prepared, and you're waiting and watching. You know what the Megillah calls him when Ahasuerus says, what should I do with Vashti? They call him Mamuchan. Muchan. He was ready. He was waiting for an opportunity, and he said, get rid of Vashti. Okay. Now, built into this was his own ambition, as we said, for greatness, and also his latent hatred of the Jews. He was also waiting for an opportunity for that. So that came later with Mordechai. As you know, Mordechai wouldn't bow down. Now, if Haman's main goal here was to destroy the Jewish people, that's what's relevant to us. What happens is, unfortunately, if you look back at the story, slowly but surely, every single attempt that Haman made to destroy us was something he decided in his heart and in his mind with no help from the outside. The only place Hashem interfered here, there's one little area where Hashem interfered. He made Ahasuerus like Esther. He made Esther be motzei chen in Ahasuerus' eyes. That was something from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Other than that, okay, everything Haman decided to do was his own brainchild, his own product of his own hatred and his own sense of, hunger for power. If Haman wanted to destroy the Jewish people, okay, what ended up happening was he didn't destroy the Jewish people. He destroyed himself. And in the process, he propelled us further along our path, closer to our goal. Who put Esther on the throne? Basically, Haman did. Okay? That was his decision to have an opportunity, get rid of Vashti and have Ahasuerus, choose somebody. Okay? Hashem made Ahasuerus find Esther, appealing. That is true. But he would have never had that opportunity without Haman's great idea. Now, here's the point. Something very interesting built into the words of the Megillah. When Shmuel Hanavi came to Shaul and said, you didn't kill Agog, Haman's great-grandfather, I am going to take away the Malchus from you, or HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to take away the Malchus from you. The words that the Navi Shmuel says to uses to Shaul is, I'm going to give the Malchus L'Re'acha HaTov Mimecha, to your friend who's better than you. When Haman tells Ahasuerus to get rid of Vashti and put someone else on the throne, they put in his mouth, obviously, Esther writing the Megillah and Mordechai put in his mouth, take away the Malchus from Vashti and give it L'Re'usa HaTova Mimena, to her friend who's better than her. In other words, what they're saying is, Haman's grandfather Agag was spared by Shaul. And that was a mistake. That proved a disaster for the Jewish people. Guess who gave Shaul's great-granddaughter back the opportunity to destroy Agag's great-grandson? Haman himself. And they use the same words. So if you think in life you never get a second chance, here's how you get the second chance, provided by the grandchild of Agag himself, straight to the grandson, the granddaughter of Shaul. So here he puts Esther basically on the throne. That's what they're saying. Now, whose idea was it to try to elevate himself by being paraded around with the king's, clothing? Uh-huh. Haman's idea. What ended up happening? He put Mordechai in a position of more power, more fame, and he was disgraced one more time. Okay? Who, by the way, offered Ahasuerus 10,000 shkalim and silver to destroy the Jews? And Ahasuerus said, keep it, it's yours. So he didn't have to pay $10,000, 10,000 shekel, and he was 10,000 shekel richer. Who ended up with that money? Who got Haman's estate when he was killed? Mordechai. He enriched Mordechai and gave him the 10,000 shkalim that were supposed to destroy the Jewish people. That was his money. Who built the gallows to hang Mordechai and ended up hanging on them? Whose idea was that? That was his idea. Okay, who sent the Jewish people basically back to Eretz Yisrael to build the base of Megdash and reestablish the Torah? Haman did. because he put Esther basically on the throne. This whole thing played out, and Daryavish, who is Darius II, is considered Esther's either biological child with Ahasuerus, or some say not biological but ideological protege, who understood and valued her ideas and sent the Jewish people back to Eretz Yisrael. So, if you were Haman and you tried again and again and again to destroy your enemy, to propel yourself forward with into a position of power, to destroy everything the Jewish people stand for, to destroy their connection to Torah, to destroy their connection to Eretz Yisrael. If you were Haman and you kept trying, and every single thing you concocted in your brain in the middle of the night as you sat there thinking and scheming, and every single thing came back to destroy you and propel your enemy forward, what do you do in the end? You give up. Not because God opened the heavens and scared you with a miracle, because you figured it out through trial and error from yourself. It's called frustration. You worked, you did your best, and you couldn't take one step forward. Eventually, when you realize that your hatred is actually promoting your enemy, and that's not what you want to do, you give up. You stand down. The miracles of Purim are the miracles of not Das, not Yediya from the outside, and we've spoken about this idea, not miracles that take place beyond our, outside of ourselves, from another dimension, from another sphere, open miracles from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that leads to Das, that gives us knowledge, but that knowledge doesn't necessarily transform a person because it comes from the outside. What transforms a person is Hakara, we've spoken about this, recognition, that transforms a person because it comes from the inside. Because it becomes not a learned truth that you discover. It becomes a self-evident truth that you just know because you've lived it. So what happens here is that all those 1,000 years of miracles, those were 1,000 years when we were in our infancy, in our childhood, maybe even in our adolescence, where the parent has to teach and instruct and show and impose. But in the end, we know you learn from experience. You learn from trial and error. A person learns from trial and error. We had to move past that era, which is called the darkness, because it doesn't really illuminate the inner recesses of a person's mind and inner recesses of a person's soul in the deepest sense. It's still darkness. And we had to move into an era, which was the era of Gullus, thousands of years, where we would learn and we would understand and there would be awe, but it would come from inside ourselves. And that's transformative, and that's lenetzach. Chuasam ha'yisa lenetzach. That's forever. So Esther is at the very beginning of the Gullus. However, what she's there for is a glimpse at the light at the end of history. Now, we've spoken about the idea here that from Gullus Bavel through the Second Temple era into this long 2,000-year Gullus, that's all one era. Remember we talked about this? That's really all the same. No Nevuah, no open miracles, Hester Panim. Esther is the beginning. We talked about Hanukkah. Hanukkah is the gateway to the Gullus. In other words, it really begins the journey. But Esther, which preceded Hanukkah by hundreds of years, gives us a glimpse at what's going to be at the end before we actually get going on the real, before we actually start, taking those steps down the road that we have to take. So that's why Esther is the end of Tanakh, and she's right in the Megillah, the miracles of Purim, are right butting up on the miracles of Pesach because they complete the circle. What Hashem attempted to do on Pesach is completed on Purim, but in a whole different way. Now the wine. That's really the secret of the wine. On Pesach, we drink wine, it punctuates the Haggadah, which is question-answer. Question-answer, discovery. Discovery. Information from the outside that has to be carefully processed, logically developed, explained, and wine, the wine of Pesach punctuates that process. Okay? But the wine of Purim is much more free-flowing. It's ad lo yada, until you don't have das. That's the big word here. Until you don't need das. Das is information from the outside. Purim is not about learning information and having it imposed upon us, and therefore understanding it, and therefore transforming. Purim is when the transformation is automatic because the experience is visceral. It's a self-evident truth. Doesn't have to be taught. And therefore, when you drink on Purim, it's ad lo yada, without das. It's not the das of revelation. You don't know the difference between Baruch Mordechai and Arar Haman. Now, why not? Why not? Notice this about wine. When you pluck a grape off a vine, what bracha do you make? Ha'etz. Is a vine a ha'etz? In a way, but not quite. 10 years later, when you're drinking this beverage that doesn't look like a grape and doesn't taste like a grape, and you wouldn't even know it came from a grape if someone didn't teach you, what bracha do you make? A guffin. So are you getting further from your source or closer to your source? Closer. You're saying bore pri hagafen when you're drinking wine. You're relating it back to its shoresh. The further you get, Rav Hunter points this out, the further you get along the road and you transform into a whole different quality takes over. And it's almost unrecognizable from the beginning, like the miracles of Purim are very different than the miracles of Pesach. Make no mistake about it. You're not getting further. You're coming full circle, but in a whole new way. In a whole new way. That way is really a completion. We talk about Purim and we say what happened was v'nahafochu, right? It was turned around. Right? When people say v'nahapochu, we normally think of inside out, upside down, but that's not what v'nahapochu means. V'nahapochu doesn't mean, in a way, reverse. V'nahapochu is like in Pirkei Avos, hafochvo v'hafochvo ki kulo bo. What does it mean, hafochvo? Turn it and turn it and turn it, and you'll see everything's in it. What's hapochu? It's like you're looking at a crystal ball, something beautiful. You keep turning it. But hapochu means keep turning it. Think about it. When you see a sphere, and you have a line at the outside of the sphere, and you turn it, what happens to that line? Where does it end up? There is no beginning, and there is no end. It's one line, and it only goes in one direction. And it doesn't go, and it can't go anywhere but back to its beginning. Jewish history is not a linear line on a flat surface, on a road. And the Goyim and their enemies can come and rip us off that road and drop us on the side and there we stay. Or take that road and make it turn left and go off in the wrong direction. That is not what happens in Jewish history. The road that we travel in Jewish history is like the outside of a sphere. Inevitably, it will absolutely happen that we will come back to the beginning, come back to where we started, come back to that moment of Giloy Shechina. And here's the frustration of Haman. There is nothing anyone can do to make that road go anywhere but back to the beginning. Everything that happens propels us back to our beginning, propels us forward in a sense to the starting point, which is the great revelation, which will take place again, but that will be a whole nother type of revelation from inside the people as opposed to from outside. Everything will come back full circle. V'nahapochu means that it doesn't matter if it's Baruch Mordechai or it's Arar Haman. It doesn't matter which way you turn it. Mordechai's Avodah, his tshuva, his tefillah, his leading Klal Yisrael, that propelled us forward. Haman's hatred, Haman's attempt to destroy us, that propelled us forward. It doesn't matter. Our worst enemies, our greatest leaders, everybody can't help but push us back to our beginning. Who sent us back to Eretz Yisrael 50, 60 years ago, if you think about it? Hitler sent us back. Now, Hitler, the Holocaust was a Purim story, except that in the Purim story the Holocaust was averted, and in our story it wasn't. So when we don't understand the way Hashem conducts the world, but divorcing it from emotions, he sent us back en masse and then practically built the country with his own money, and now they're depopulating because their job is done and they have no reason to live, and they are rapidly, alarmingly to some, depopulating the whole Germany, except for the Arabs that are moving in. But that's who sent us back. In other words, it doesn't matter. At a certain point in Purim, Adelo Yada, you don't have to get up anymore. At this stage, at the end, when all of the nations of the world look back and say, we've all tried, we've all made our best attempts, used all our money, all our energy, everything we have to try to rip these people away from their goal, to try to destroy this rushing river that's going forward towards its destination. We've all tried to take it off course. We've all tried to dam it up. We've all tried to eliminate it. Every one of us has tried, and none of us have succeeded, and we've all gone down the tubes in the process. So, at a certain point, you give up, and the river keeps rushing forward. That is really the concept of Aror, of Haman and Baruch Mordechai. You don't need das. You don't need to stand up anymore and say, make speeches like we still have to do. Arguing for the legitimacy of the survival of the Jewish people, that we're not the evil Goliath threatening the poor little David, okay? That we do we have contributed valuable things to humanity, that we're not the most evil people on earth, that you don't have to actually make arguments and write letters to the editor and make speeches that Iran is bad and our enemies are, you know, are evil and they need to be stopped, as if you have to teach people this from a logical standpoint. It's going to be self-evident that the Jewish people, who we are, our role that we play, our right to survive, and everybody else will surrender and submit because they will have been so frustrated along the way. But the point is, at that point, everybody will know it. That's the concept of the free-flowing wine, that the wine is Borei Pri HaGafen. We'll come back to the beginning. Everyone will know it. Doesn't matter, Baruch Mordechai or Haman, it's going in one direction, and nobody can stop it. It's not always painless, but nobody can stop it. Now, this is what happens. In the beginning, HaKadosh Baruch Hu held the mountain over their heads and said, you are compelled. What happened on Purim? We accepted the Torah with love and willingly. What does that mean? What does that mean? The Torah in the beginning was accepted with das, revelation, overwhelming revelation, to the point that what happened to the Jewish people when they heard the first two dibros from Hashem himself?
No.
Their neshamas left their bodies. In other words, it was not something they could sustain in physical, you know, as a regular physical person. It was from outside of themselves. It was lamala min haguf, beyond their physical, beyond their bodies. It was when the neshamas had to separate. But that's not the reality of Jewish history. The reality of Jewish history is our neshamas live in our bodies, and through our bodies themselves we come to recognize Hashem, through our life, not in the situation that was like in another zone where we were no longer able to be both human and experience the revelation, and our neshamas had experienced it almost separately from our bodies. That's not the final goal for the Jewish people. The final goal is through our bodies, in a harmony of body and soul, we teach these lessons, we accept these lessons. Do you know what it means when we say that kiblu, the kimu, the kiblu, we re-accepted the Torah on Purim? You know what we accepted? We accepted not to be witnesses and spectators and therefore, in a sense, responsible for teaching the truth that Hashem was revealing at Har Sinai. We agreed to be the players in which these truths would be played out through our lives. The Kabbalah Satorah of Purim was we agreed that these truths would become self-evident through them being expressed through the experience of the Jewish people themselves. We would not be spectators, we'd be the vehicles. In the beginning, we were the spectators. We saw it, and we would have to say what we saw. That couldn't change everybody, transform everybody. What transforms everybody is a Kabbalah Satorah, that we're going to appreciate the truth and be the vehicles of its expression. So every single Jew who went to a gas chamber saying Shema or Ani Mamin was a vehicle to teach. You can destroy me, you can destroy 6 million of me, but you will never stop the river from rushing forward. You will be lost, you will be forgotten, and the Jewish people will reemerge once again and move forward until the end of days, in which case we are waiting for Tchias HaMesim, and all those people along the way will be reunited with us somehow, some way, however it works. So we agreed to be Mekabel the Torah in a whole different way, to be the vehicles for the Torah story. And we did that out of love. And the fact that we're still sitting here, and there are still yeshivas, and there are still, and Eretz Yisrael is being built further, and Judaism is developing, and there's so much outreach going on, that's the proof. We've been through the Holocaust, and we're still doing this. So we've accepted it with love. That's the R of Purim. Lehudim Haisa Ora V'Simcha. Now here we go into a pasuk in Kisisa, next week's Parsha. It's a very strange pasuk, by the way. It says, Purim, as we said, is Or, the light. The Yehuda Maisa, Ora v'Simcha. But it's the light that comes from Hakara, recognition. And it's the light of the Shachar, the dawn, that really will change things. Self-evident truth, experience, trial and error, and a love, a loving acceptance of this type of a process. That's the miracles of Purim, the Shachar. But there's also Or, light, that we associate with a major character in the month of Adar, born and died in Adar, Moshe Rabbeinu. His face also shone with light, and he was also, by the way, the house filled with light when he was born. But the Pasuk in Kisisa says, in Pasuk Chavtes, Perek Lamed Dalid, Vayhi Beredes Moshe Mehar Sinai. Moshe came down from Har Sinai. Ushnei Luchos Ha'edus Biad Moshe, Beredeto Minahar. And he had the two laws of the two luchas in his hand when he came down the mountain. Umoshe lo yada, and Moshe didn't know. Listen carefully. Moshe lo yada. We're talking with das, Pesach, ad lo yada. Moshe lo yada, ki karan or panav, that the skin of his face became radiant, the dabro ito, when a God had spoken to him. So, if you ask anyone, why did Moshe's face become radiant? Everyone will answer, because of this revelation that he experienced, which illuminated his face. But that revelation was from the outside, was Das. Moshe was up on the mountain and Hashem must have taught him. And that's why he was radiating. Rashi says something striking. He brings down from the Tanchuma, he says like this, Mehechan Zacha Moshe Lekarnei Ahod, where did Moshe... Why was he privileged for these rays of splendor? Rabbi Seinu Amru, min ha-ma'ara, from the cave. Remember when he said to Hashem, Hareini na durachecha, show me your ways? And Hashem said, lo yirani ha-adam v'chai. No, I can't reveal that much. He says, but I'll put you in a crevice, and I'll pass in front of you, which we don't even know what that means, and I'll put my palm over you and cover you so you won't see. And then I'll pass by and remove my hand or whatever, and then you'll know. And then Moshe called out them 13 midas harachamim. So Rabbi Seinu Amru, Rabbi say, min hamara, from that cave, that crevice Moshe was in, shenasan HaKadosh Baruch Hu yado alpanav, when Hashem put his hand, so to speak, over Moshe's face, shenemar, as it says, and he quotes the pasuk, v'sakosi kapi, I will cover you with my hand. Umoshe lo yada, because it didn't come from Das, because he didn't see, because it wasn't revealed, that's why there was Or. Because that Or came from inside Moshe, not from the revelation from the outside. Ki lo yada, that's how you read the pasuk. Umoshe lo yada, ki karan or pano. And Moshe didn't know, and that's why his face was shining light. The R comes in the end, like Hudim Haisa Ora comes in the end from Adalo Yada, not because it comes from the outside, but because it comes from the inside, from Hakara. So the miracle of Purim certainly is the miracles of the end of days. We hope we're very far along on that journey. By the way, on the words, like Hudim Haisa Ora, V'Simcha, V'Sasan, V'Yikar Chazal, Darshan, four mitzvahs that they kind of reaffirmed, and they all have to do with the body itself and not an out-of-body experience. Ki laihudim haisa ora v'simcha v'sasan v'yikar relate to yantiv, bris milah, tefillin, and Torah. Now, tefillin is on the body of a man, bris milah is on the body, and yantiv is simchas yantiv, which is chatzili, chatzilochem, eating and drinking, and Torah, which is Or. These are things that through the body and through physical life and experience, not from some outside thing, but the body itself, the life itself, we understand and we receive the Or. So what we're really saying is that it's not just for the Jewish people as a whole, but every individual person on Purim, in this hidden type of way, with the costumes and the parties and everything that seems so far from Yom Kippur and so far from, you know, the holiest of moments, that is under all of that hidden joy, okay, under all of that outward joy rather, is really the most hidden secret of all. The secret that, in the end, The Hakara is dawning. The recognition is dawning. Hashem's presence among us. Our future is guaranteed. We just have to be a part of that future. That's our choice. But the future itself is guaranteed. And the Jewish people will survive. And eventually everyone will know. And that will be La Netzach. That will be eternal. And that will be transformative. And Purim will never be batal because of it. And in every person's own personal life, in the end, we learn so much Torah, but through personal experience we come to hakara, to recognition, from looking inside oneself. And we've spoken about that idea, and we've spoken about Rav Amiel Sefer really is a work on this subject, Light for an Age of Confusion. We've spoken about the Ani, looking inside oneself to the self-evident truths that we come to know as we mature, and that brings us to an understanding, and a deeper understanding. And we hope that we're Zocha this year, very soon. Pesach is really Nisan is the month of Geula, that we should be Zocha to live through the real Geula. And I always think, by the way, you know, despite all of the long history behind us and how any researcher, any historian can look back and see what we've spoken about, how every nation has tried and ended up frustrated and ended up, you know, destroying themselves, you know, and come to their senses and kind of give up, you know, just like Lara for evil in 9/11, in like 1 second, we all kind of woke up and we got it. We got what was out there, what forces were against us, not only the Jews, but against Western life. We just got it in a second, the hatred, the determination, the whole thing, and, you know. So also for good, in 1 second, something can turn around and everybody will get it, you know, for in clarity and for in a positive way, and all of a sudden we'll be standing there, and everything will make sense all of a sudden. We just hope that we are ra'oi for this this geula b'mehira b'yameinu. I just want to add one little thing. Michael, this is a great book, The Secrets of the Sistine Chapel. You know the horns on Moshe's head and the Moses. Michelangelo was not an Am HaAretz. Okay, you can read, there's a lot of proof here. He knew Torah and Medrash very, very well. He understood those were rays of light. There's a very interesting section here that that statue was originally supposed to be in a different location in St. Peter's, and he made these little protrusions, and it was sitting under a skylight and in a certain angle so that when the sun would shine, they would actually look like rays of light, but then it was moved to a different location, put in under a dark ceiling, and unfortunately what he did there turned out to just look like protrusions, but he meant them to be rays of light. Yeah. Okay.
Everybody stay for 2 seconds.
Everybody stay for a second.